From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. How will the demise of traditional newspapers and the continued rise of the internet change the way you and I get our news and entertainment? Today I'm joined by former FCC commissioner, now law professor, Nicholas Johnson. He's best known for his controversial term as a dissenting FCC commissioner in the late 60s and early 70s, and his book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. In his new book, Your Second Priority, he shares complaints and suggestions for understanding and improving today's mass media. Our discussion with Nicholas Johnson starts right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest this hour is Nicholas Johnson. He's best known for his controversial term as a dissenting Federal Communications Commission commissioner. Appointed by President Johnson, he served as FCC commissioner from 1966 to 1973. In 1970, he helped spark a media reform movement with his book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. His ideas put his face on the cover of Rolling Stone in 1971. Now, nearly four decades later, he teaches at the University of Iowa College of Law with a special emphasis on communications and internet law. In his new book titled Your Second Priority, he shares complaints and suggestions for understanding and improving today's mass media. Nicholas Johnson joins me this morning in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Ben. Thank you.
Great to have you in our studio again. This hour, we want to get your observations on how the mass media has changed over recent decades, and most recently the rise of the internet, and how the way we consume media is undergoing a dramatic shift. We also want to talk about the collapse of leading newspapers, traditional newspapers around the country, and the effect the economic turmoil is having in our media, and of course try to include as many listener calls and emails as possible this hour. First of all, tell us why you titled this book Your Second Priority.
Well, the reason for that is that as I was trying to build coalitions in the 60s and 70s, I explained to folks that whatever their first priority was, whether it was feeding the hungry or saving the whales or women's rights or whatever, that their second priority at least had to be media reform, because the media is so central to bringing about change or preventing the bringing about of change, that unless you understand it, unless you work to try to reform it, unless you work to try to democratize it, make it more responsive to your own first priority, you don't have much chance of making any progress. And even with the media reform, you may not make all the progress you'd like, but at least you have a fighting chance.
So when we look back, let's just take the last 100 years as a good place to look at mass media, from newspapers 100 years ago, from newspapers to radio, and then supposedly, television was going to kill radio, and then we have television evolving into cable television, and now we have the demise of traditional newspapers. We have all this online action, convergence online of material that we read, we listen to, and we watch. What do you make of it when you look over that span of 100 years and how media has evolved?
Well, how about a span of 600 years? Because okay. We used to teach with lectures. And then Gutenberg gave us the printing press, although the Koreans gave it to us 600 years before that. And yet, even with books, we are still lecturing on the University of Iowa campus today, oftentimes with material that might better have been in print and have required reading for students. So the printing press did not drive out the public lecture. Indeed, I did a public lecture business for a while in the 70s and 80s. You mentioned newspapers, and radio came along, AM radio. It didn't do away with newspapers. It affected what newspapers can most effectively do, which is true today as well. And there was concern then about FM radio when it came along, and then television. Who'd want to listen to radio when they could watch television? Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out as many people are listening to radio as are watching television at any given time. It hasn't done away with radio, which serves some very useful purposes. If you're not supposed to use your cell phone while driving, it's also very difficult to be watching television while driving, but you can listen to the radio while driving. And now we had cable to bring us television and satellite distributed television, and none of that did away with the over the air television stations. And now we have the internet, and you can read the newspaper on the internet. You can listen to this radio station on the internet. You can watch ABC Evening News on the internet. And yet, all of those media still exist, newspapers and radio and television, over-the-air stations and so forth. So I think that while each new developed medium has an impact, and now the networks are looking at delivering television programs over cell phone mm-hmm. screens, each has its impact, but the others tend to come along in one form or another.
So do you think that the shift that currently going on towards the internet is another of the sort of piling on of the next new media and not a replacement of prior media?
Well, it's going to be a replacement to some effect. You've got to respond in the same way that the newspapers that had the extra read all about it and morning editions and afternoon editions and evening editions couldn't really keep up with radio news and so needed to go more to a daily edition, probably a morning paper, with more insight into the stories of what happened the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a modification with the coming of radio. And I think with the coming of the internet, a lot of newspapers now are trying to come up, well, not just newspapers, but radio stations, television, everybody's trying to come up with some business model
mm-hmm.
that will enable the newspapers to stay in business. But so far, at least, there's still a demand, mostly for people who are over 80, probably, for hard copy newspapers. But there's still a demand out there. They give them away free in the cafeterias here on campus, trying to entice students to this newfangled communication device called a newspaper, which most of them find quite alien, even when they're free.
Now, you are involved just personally with an experiment with your wife that you shared with me coming in that sort of tests out where we are in terms of the internet and availability of media. Tell us about that experiment.
Well, we've never really been very heavy television watchers. I mean, after I spent a professional career advising people to take John Prine's advice and blow up their TV and move to the country, I couldn't very well be a heavy TV watcher. But we watch the evening news on ABC. We watch George Stephanopoulos Sunday morning. We watch some of the PBS stuff, particularly my old friend Bill Moyers. And what we discovered, and Jon Stewart, of course, oh my goodness, to really explain what's going on in America. And what we've discovered is that the programs that we actually watched and cared about are all available on the internet, along, of course, with most radio programming as well, along with YouTube and all kinds of stuff in addition. But so our experiment this week is to see if we can go Sunday through Saturday without actually turning on the television set, as distinguished from not watching any television content, because what we want to watch, we can watch on our laptops. And what we're discovering is that we are watching less because what we have now is a free universal TiVo that's recording everything for us and mm-hmm. making it available whenever we want it. And one of the consequences of that is you just tend not to want it if you do. See, television programs your life. There's a time when the program comes on.
Right.
And if you don't watch it then, unless you got a TiVo, if you don't watch it then, you're never going to get to see it. So you've got to build your life around, you know, I can't go to the meeting this evening because my favorite show comes on tonight, kind of thing. And So in any event, we're only in the second day of this week-long experiment, or third day, and so far so good.
Do you have any concerns that the razzle-dazzle of the internet age, all these things that you can, the video, the effects that you can get online, are somewhat distracting from journalistic quality? Thinking perhaps of the example, I don't know if you watched election night, CNN, they beamed in a correspondent into be in the studio with Wolf Blitzer as an example of technology, perhaps for its own sake. What does that add to journalistic quality?
Well, that's always been there, hasn't it? I mean, from the days of the circuses, and I mean, and the magicians, and I mean, everybody likes razzle dazzle, and journalism certainly has never been above that.
Mm-hmm. So, what are your concerns when you do this personal experiment and you observe the media over recent years? Your concerns when it comes to your second priority, the future of the mass media.
Well, I think we need to realize how important media is in every aspect of our lives. And it's not just second priority for people who are trying to bring about some social, political, public policy change, whether of the left or the right. But it's also an issue of how do junior high school girls think about themselves and what they think is important and valuable and how thin they should be and so forth, which mm-hmm. is Reviving Ophelia, that's the book I'm trying to think of. It's our economy, the propelling of all of us into conspicuous consumption, spending more money than we have on things we don't need, and once we get them, discover we don't like and don't use, that has helped to drive us into the economic disaster that we're in at the moment, is partly the responsibility of the mass media. How we understand our role in the world. If you're not listening to BBC audio, which this station carries during the night from 11 p.m. until 5 a.m.
And also at 3 p.m.
And 3 p.m. in the afternoon for an hour, there are going to be a large number of countries you've never heard of, where things are going on that are going to impact on us economically, militarily, in terms of terrorism, in terms of global trade. You haven't even heard of the country, you know, let alone know anything about what's going on in the country unless you're listening to the BBC. That's a consequence of a need for reform.
We have to take a short break, and then we'll be back in just a moment with former FCC commissioner, now University of Iowa law faculty person, Nicholas Johnson. Your Second Priority is the title of his latest book. He shares complaints and suggestions for understanding and improving today's mass media in the new book. We'd like to get your thoughts and questions concerning the regulation of media in the age of the internet. Do we need any regulation? What about a new fairness doctrine? That's what we'll talk about when we come back, the possible revival of the fairness doctrine. How have you changed the way you consume media in recent years? Are you better or worse off than you were before the internet? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. We'll be right back. My guest today has served as the FCC commissioner from 1966 to 1973. He was appointed by President Johnson in 1970. He helped spark a media reform movement with his book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. Now, nearly four decades later, his new book is titled Your Second Priority, talking about understanding and improving today's mass media. Nicholas Johnson is with us now on the faculty at the University of Iowa College of Law. Entertaining your questions and comments, 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. What are your concerns about the regulation or non-regulation of the media in the age of the internet? Do we need any regulation? 1-866-780-9100. And what does this, the new media environment, the evolving media environment, Nick Johnson, mean? What does it mean for local consumption of media that really concerns our lives in our local communities?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because just before the break, I was talking about the importance of our understanding what's going on globally in a variety of countries that impact upon us. But obviously, somebody's going to be covering those stories. I mentioned the BBC. Locally, if you don't have local media covering the stories, nobody's covering the stories. I used to say I could walk into a town and look around the town and tell you something about the quality of its local newspaper. Because the communitarian idea of Amitai Etzioni, the holding together of a community, the building of a community, a sense of community spirit, the kind of thing that happened during the floods when we came together to to help each other, that's dependent upon local media. And we don't have local media when we have stations owned by distant chains and conglomerates and whatever. Some Iowa City, Johnson County, Eastern Iowa citizens have come together for FM Iowa under a new provision of the FCC that permits local, relatively low-power FM stations. And they now have a license for one in Iowa City, KUBU 89.5, maybe. I don't know. I'll have to check and see the exact frequency. Mm-hmm. It's not on the air yet, but will be. And that's something where folks in this community can come and contribute programming and work with those folks. There are also three or four stations elsewhere around the state of Iowa. So this is not something that's limited to Iowa City. This is statewide, and it's going to be a new movement. And I think it will help in building community, holding people in the communities who otherwise might be leaving the state and so forth.
Isn't there less of an emphasis on traditional terrestrial radio, though, when anybody can have an internet radio station?
Yeah, but anybody can't be broadcasting to someone who's driving across the state or sitting in their tractor and tending to their crops, working in the shop. You're not going to be hooking up your laptop in the midst of all that to listen. The radio is still there. As I was walking over here this morning listening to the radio, I would not have been carrying a laptop and listening to that, or a handheld device getting it off the internet. You can just pick it up off the air.
If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Iowa City. Ray is with us. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I have a large concern about all of this saturation advertising that we're experiencing. Take CNN, for example. I mean, they can't even complete a thought without having to go to advertising. And the consequence of that is we get no thoughts. All we get is advertising. And if all we're going to have is advertising, then I'm for just cutting the line. I mean, if they want to advertise 24 hours a day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could do this. Maybe all the advertisers could have 60 channels of advertising, and then we could have, I don't know, 20, 30 channels of programming. And if you want to sit and spend your whole life watching advertising, then fine, do it. But for the few of us that are left on this planet that would like a whole program and a whole thought, you know, I would appreciate at least one channel beyond Channel 13, which is Iowa Public Television, and they do a great job. But I would appreciate at least one other channel that has an actual program on it.
Ray, how like it or not, that's the way we fund commercial television, commercial radio in this country. How do you propose
Well, Canadian television isn't funded that way, or is it?
Is there the political will for us to tax our people to support broadcasters? It hasn't happened so far.
Well, I've been in a number of other countries, and they do it in a completely different way in other countries. There are commercials, but there are also much larger segments of programming. I mean, I realize the financial pinch everybody's in today, but believe me, it doesn't do gray matter any good to have all of this parsing of programs into minute segments and then these large blocks of advertising. I mean, Nick is well aware that there was this whole debate back in the 60s and 70s about is television pitched to the IQ of a three-year-old? And I don't frankly see that we've progressed very much beyond that point in 2009.
Okay, Ray, let me ask Professor Johnson for a comment on your comments.
Well, I think this is simply one example of the United States' commitment to for-profit everything, privatizing, contracting out. Civilized nations, industrialized nations that put a greater value on the welfare of their people, virtually all have, for example, universal single-payer health care. The idea of running the health care system as a profit-making business is an anathema to them. They fund public broadcasting because they see its value and importance to their culture and to the education of the people and the information they need to intelligently participate in self-governing. At the time we created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and soon thereafter, we were never willing to spend more than 1% of what civilized nations spend on public broadcasting, whether you measure it in absolute dollars or per capita cost or percentage of gross domestic product. We're just not interested in what I described as a communitarian movement, the interest in social good, in public good. Reagan got elected on the motto that the government is the problem, not the solution. Right now, the Obama administration is having difficulty taking over the banks, as virtually everybody says they should, in the way that Sweden did at one point, because it raises the word nationalization. And nationalization is thought to be socialism, and socialism is thought to be communism, and communism is thought to be the epicenter of the axis of evil. And there you have it. So I think this is just one example of ways in which we pay a price for corporatizing everything.
Ray, thank you very much for your comment from Iowa City. Right before our break, we've got a couple minutes left. Let's go to Janet in Cedar Falls. Janet, are you there? Janet is not there. We've got some sort of technical problem with that. Mike is in Iowa City. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. Nick, I know that, this is your second priority, obviously the name of the book. I've been working on media reform for a number of years, as you well know. But another one of my priorities is campaign finance reform, and I call it my first priority. If my second priority is media reform, then my first priority might be campaign finance reform to level the playing field so the people can really get what they want. I would like your thoughts on campaign finance reform.
Okay, we've got about a minute left, a connection there.
Okay. Mike's absolutely right that until you get campaign finance reform, you're not going to get reform of anything else. I was on the National Board of Common Cause for a while, and what we discovered after nearly 30 years of trying to get meaningful campaign finance reform is that apparently legislation has to be passed by incumbents. And it turns out that incumbents are not in favor of changing a system that profits them very nicely and returns them to office with all of its perks. And the people who pay the money sort of softly grumble about it. But since they get back 1,000 to 2,000 to 1 on what they've contributed, they're actually rather satisfied with it as well.
We have to take a short break. Thank you, Mike, calling from Iowa City. Join our conversation when we come back with former FCC Commissioner, now UI faculty member, Nicholas Johnson. What are your thoughts and questions concerning the regulation of media in the Internet age? Do we need any regulation? What sort? And how have you changed the way you consume media in recent years? Are you better or worse off than you were before the Internet? 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Tomorrow on this program, we celebrate Peace Corps Week by talking to volunteers who have been in the Peace Corps around the world. They'll share their experiences. It was in 1961 that John F. Kennedy started the Peace Corps. At that time, Kennedy saw it as a means of countering the notions of the ugly American and Yankee imperialism. Now, President Obama plans to double the Peace Corps by 2011. Tomorrow, We'll look at the Peace Corps and hear from some volunteers who've served around the world here on The Exchange. Today we're talking with Nicholas Johnson, best known as a controversial dissenting Federal Communications Commission commissioner appointed by President Johnson. That was nearly four decades ago. He also wrote a book, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set Then. These ideas put his face on the cover of Rolling Stone in 1971. Now he's a University of Iowa College of Law professor, emphasizing work on communications and internet law. Your Second Priority is the title of his latest book. He shares in it complaints and suggestions for understanding and improving today's mass media. What are your thoughts and questions concerning the regulation of media in the internet age? Do we need any regulations? Let the market dictate what happens out there? What about a revival of the fairness doctrine? We want to turn our sights on that here in just a moment. That telephone number for joining our conversation, 1-866-780-9100 is the number, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Professor Johnson, recently media outlets have been abuzz with talk of a reinstatement of the fairness doctrine. Some Democratic legislators have expressed interest in reinstituting the fairness doctrine. No one has introduced legislation to do so since 2005, according to my information. Now, this month, Senator Tom Harkin said in an interview with Politico.com, "We got to get the fairness doctrine back in law again." In response to that, Iowa Congressman Steve King said, "It is incredible that in today's modern media age, where information is easily accessible in so many different forms, Tom Harkin wants to squelch your First Amendment rights in favor of Chinese-style censorship," according to Iowa Congressman Steve King. Now, Professor Johnson, there are many out there who are wondering, what exactly is the Fairness Doctrine? Get us up to speed on that. What is it? What was it? Why was it created? And why was it revoked?
Stephen King's comment reminds me of a law professor's remark to a student in a class I was attending. It was not me. Following a particularly inapposite recitation, the professor said, "Young man, you have a capacity for subtracting rather than adding to the sum total of human knowledge." So let me take it from the top, as we say in Hollywood. It's virtually impossible for a professional journalist to violate the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine came about because the station is granted a monopoly by the federal government in the form of the Federal Communications Commission to operate on a given frequency in a given community during given hours. And it is very much like the responsibility of a member of Congress who probably will be reelected but does not have a constitutional right to be reelected. The broadcasters operated under a license for a fixed term, initially 18 months, subsequently extended to 3 years. Most of them got a renewal of their license, but they had no right to have a renewal of their license. They are a community asset. They are like an elected public official. They are there to serve the community. And so what that meant was that they could not engage in unrelieved propaganda from one point of view. The station could not. And that was considered the Fairness Doctrine and something the FCC had created and Congress went along with. And then in 1958, I believe it was actually or I believe it was enacted into a provision of the Communications Act. What it provides simply are two things. The first is not known by many broadcasters, and that was that they are required to cover controversial issues of public importance, that you can't just run a radio station as a jukebox with commercials. You have to have some news, some public affairs, some dealing with the issues confronting your community for the reasons that we were talking about before the break. The second provision, most of them did know about, and that was that when you do that, you need to present a range of views on that subject. You can't just hammer away on one side of it. There was not a requirement of a particular format. There was not a requirement you put any named individual on the air. There was not a requirement of equal time. It was simply a requirement that you could not use your station as an unrelieved instrument of propaganda for a single point of view. It was ultimately repealed as a result of pressure from the Broadcasters Trade Association, notwithstanding the fact that many news directors told me they thought it was terrific because when the advertising vice president came in and said, "You guys have got to lay off going after that used car dealer. We're losing advertising revenue." They were able to respond to the advertising vice president by saying, "Hey, look, we're terribly sorry, but the fairness doctrine of the FCC requires us to do that. Otherwise, we may lose our license."
So this was revoked in the 1980s during the Reagan term.
Yeah, I believe so.
So the effect of that revocation was?
Well, the effect of the revocation was to remove from the station this limitation on propagandizing. As I say, a professional journalist couldn't violate it. Why? What does a professional journalist do? They look for controversial issues. That's how you build audience. That's how you build readership in your newspaper. And when you write the story, you talk to a variety of people and get different points of view. Why? Because it makes a better story. So there's nothing in the fairness doctrine that impedes good quality journalism. What the conservatives are arguing is, oh, if you pass the fairness doctrine, you're trying to get rid of Rush Limbaugh. Well, what's wrong with that is that the fairness doctrine has nothing to do with Rush Limbaugh. Any station that wants to carry Limbaugh or Hannity or any of the other right-wing commentators or the Air America or whatever is perfectly free to do it. It's just that, and the program has no obligation to comply with the fairness doctrine. The obligation to comply with the fairness doctrine is on the station. So they have to have some other programming on than just one conservative talk show host after another for 24 hours running. But aside from that, they can have any given program on, and there's no requirement that the content of an individual program be interfered with.
I wanted to play this ad. Was posted on the website protectfairness.com in response to Senator Harkin's comments.
The biggest spending bill in U.S. history passed with no debate, no transparency. The mainstream media out to lunch, refusing to ask the tough questions. Now politicians like Clinton, Schumer, and Pelosi want to reward the liberal media. They call it the Fairness Doctrine. We call it censorship. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin says we need to bring the Fairness Doctrine back. Shame on you, Senator Harkin. Stop the unfairness doctrine. Visit protectfairness.com today. Paid for by the United Republican Fund.
So it seems that there's a basic misunderstanding or not meeting of minds as to what the Fairness Doctrine is. Here, this group sees it as censorship of censorship.
Well, I think there's a deliberate effort to misrepresent what it was, what it existed. I think they are either incredibly ignorant or willingly manipulative in a fraudulent way in describing it the way that spot describes it.
Now, in June of 2008, Barack Obama, on the campaign trail, his press secretary wrote that Obama does not support reimposing the Fairness Doctrine on broadcasters. And then in February of 2009, this month, a White House spokesperson said that President Obama continues to oppose the revival of the doctrine. Do you know anything behind that? What could be behind that?
Well, I would rather not comment on that because I think we need to support our president at the moment to see if he can get us through this economic collapse. And following which, I will be happy to tell you everything I think about that particular position.
Okay. Let's go to our callers. Running out of time, let's go to Waterloo, where Dave has been standing by. Good morning, Dave. Welcome to our program. Dave, are you there? Dave has left. Let's go to Julie in Belle Plaine. Hi, Julie.
Hi. How are you all doing today?
We're doing fine. How are you?
Thank you very much for your intelligent discussion. Thank you very much for coming on the program, Mr. Johnson, and thanks to NPR and IPR for carrying it.
Very good. What's your question?
I wanted to weigh in. I appreciate your bringing up the Fairness Doctrine, and I wanted to say I think that should be done also because it does speak to the constitutional mission of a free press, and the function within a democracy, which is to allow debate and entertain the diversity of views among the people. And the whole concept of democracy is that from many different ideas, we get to choose the best ones and decide which we think are the best ones as a free people. And I think that if the Fairness Doctrine is applied in spirit and intent, that there would be less, there would be more facts, more information, less spin, and that the people need the information in the form of facts, not judgments and opinions. And although certain programs, as Mr. Johnson brought up, they're free to get on their soapbox, there still should be a balance in there so that the entire range of debate among a diverse people is entertained. So thank you very much for your program, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Julie, calling from Belle Plaine.
Well, I think Julie's got it. And she were one of my law students and put that on the final exam, she'd get an A. I think she understands what it's about.
Here's an email from Ben in Iowa City that goes along these lines. Ben asks, with only a handful of companies owning many of the country's newspapers, radio, and TV stations, what is the risk to elections? Is it possible for one or two companies to influence the elections of a majority of our representatives?
Well, I think absolutely so, and I think it's very dangerous. And I've, in your second priority, one of the sections of the book deals with media ownership issues. We're seeing the same thing now with the banks, the argument that a bank is too big to fail. And my response to that is, if you're too big to fail, you're too big. I would say the same about media. We talked about the value of local media to the local community, building the local community economically, culturally, and so forth. And it's very difficult to do that when the local station is run remotely by somebody in L.A. or Miami or New York who's never been to the Iowa town where the station's located.
Another email, anonymous email, is the real threat to news a declining interest among young people other than The Daily Show, which you mentioned earlier? What news do they get?
Well, let us not forget blogs, said the blogger of From D.C. to Iowa, blogspot.com. And I think that is one of the phenomena now going on with the Internet. And I don't mean to suggest that from D.C. to Iowa, blogspot.com is truly the equivalent of the New York Times, though I do believe there are some mornings when it comes very close. But there's an enormous amount out there now. I think some 100 million blogs is at it. I'm trying to – yeah, that'd be about right. And I think they have had some impact, and I think it's a wonderful democratizing feature.
So this is a revival of the public square on the Internet.
It really is. And the equivalent of the single broadside newspapers of old and so forth. And now, of course, we also have, as I mentioned, community radio stations like the KUBU that's coming to eastern Iowa. And we've got right down the street from where we are the public access television, where anybody can make their own television program and put it on the cable system. And I don't mean to suggest that those are truly competing with professional journalism and mainstream media, but I do think it's become a much larger force than it ever has been before as a result of the Internet, with the blogs and YouTube and the other opportunities for people to participate in this process, and the newspapers that have on their websites an opportunity for readers to comment. And I would acknowledge that those comments are not always the most valuable.
Unmoderated, unregulated, you can get some strange comments.
Or the most civil, but it's an example of a real radical change that was once a from the few to the many is now from the few to the many and from the many back to the few.
Let's go and try Dave again. Dave called again. Good morning, Dave. We have you this time.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to make a couple real quick comments, so I'm going to get off here. Entertaining show. I guess my biggest agreement that I have is with the previous caller about all the commercialization on some of these radio stations. If they can throw $8 billion at a high-speed rail system, you know, on this stimulus package, I think they could probably fund another form of a station like NPR. I listen to NPR all the time. I listen to the BBC. And I think Mr. Johnson's right when he says that you have to be able to be informed without getting all these opinions about everything from all these economists and all these think tank people. I didn't really realize that we had all these expert economists that can determine, you know, the future of our economy. But it seems like to me, if we could get just a little bit more factual news instead of opinionated news, and maybe a little bit of good news in this day and age would probably go a long way instead of just listening to how horrible everything is and how terrible everything. I think people got a fair amount of money, maybe, but they're not going to spend it right now because that's all you hear about is, you know, how terrible everything is. I think maybe if we had a little bit of good news, maybe it would help. Thank you.
Okay, Dave, thank you for calling and winding up our show. I wanted to refocus, unless you had a comment to react to, Dave. We have an anniversary that occurred to me. Actually, I was reminded by my daughter. She's a part of the school newspaper at West High in Iowa City. She had a black armband to wear to school today. She is on the school newspaper. Today is the 40th anniversary of a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court known as Tinker versus Des Moines, which defined constitutional rights of students in U.S. public schools. And I wanted to go there because it is the anniversary, but also because it has to do with the First Amendment, which we've been talking about this whole hour. Tell us the significance of Tinker versus Des Moines, Professor Johnson.
Well, first of all, happy anniversary. I would sing happy birthday, but that song has now been copyright, and I don't have permission to sing it. My congratulations to your daughter for knowing that and for celebrating it and wearing the black armband at West High School today.
The significance of the black armband, to give some background.
It was worn by students in Des Moines High School to protest the Vietnam War. And the administration, for whatever reason, whether because they thought the Vietnam War was a really nifty thing that ought to be encouraged, or whether they legitimately felt that this was going to be disruptive, told the students they had to take off the armband, much like the principal at City High. Your daughter is with Jerry Argenbright as the principal out at West, but the principal at City High, who will go unnamed, on one occasion, simply went out and seized all the student newspapers and destroyed them because he was concerned about a story in the paper. But it goes to the First Amendment rights of students in an institutional environment such as a school. And there are some restraints on that, as there are for those who are in another kind of prison prisoners. Who can be controlled by the warden in terms of some of their free speech rights. But to the extent possible, the court has tried to expand the First Amendment rights of those who write for student papers or who have blogs or whatever. There was a recent case where a kid was not on school property, standing across the street, and there was a parade, and he had a sign, "Bong Hits for Jesus," which was thought inappropriate. But you get very colorful speech from students, and I'm usually on the side of the students, I must say.
What is in your future? We've got a couple minutes left. What is in your future? What are you working on now? What mountain are you trying to move at the moment?
Oh, well, I got these two books out last year. You very kindly did a program earlier on the other one called Are We There Yet?, which was a compilation of some of my writing about politics and government, and then this one, Your Second Priority, both of which I should say are available at Prairie Lights in Iowa City, and my website, www.nicholasjohnson.org, has links to Amazon and the publisher for both of the books. So I'm doing a lot of blogging. I've created, I don't know, well over 600 blog entries in the last couple of years, trying to keep the University of Iowa honest, which is really a full-time job. And now it's been supplanted with my efforts to revive the global economy, which is a really tough assignment.
What are your thoughts on the economic crisis and the economy that you've been writing about?
Well, I lay it all out exactly what we should do, and then usually 2 or 3 weeks later, Obama comes around and recommends what I propose. So it's a heady responsibility that I have been. Yeah.
Okay, very good. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Nicholas Johnson, former FCC commissioner, now on the University of Iowa law faculty. Your Second Priority is the title of his latest book, in which he shares complaints and suggestions for understanding and improving today's mass media. And if you'd like to get in touch with Nicholas Johnson, he just mentioned those websites and to join in on his blog. And The Exchange today, produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, production assistance from Julie Englander and John Pemble. Our producer assistant today, Scott Grattan. If you'd like to hear the entire program, perhaps you only caught part of it, podcasting or on-demand audio is available of this program by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.